Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the program, Phil Dierking tells us all about blues music. We also listen to the first part of An American Story by Edgar Allan Poe. But first, here's Anne Ball.
The spacecraft Cassini ended its 20-year mission on Friday with a final death dive into the planet Saturn. NASA scientists and officials gathered at California's Jet Propulsion Laboratory for Cassini's last moments.
Project manager, flight director.
Go ahead.
Okay, we call loss of signal at 115546.
Cassini had actually burned up like a meteor 83 minutes earlier as it dove through Saturn's atmosphere. But it took that many minutes for the news to reach Earth, more than 1.5 billion kilometers away. Program manager Earl Mays marked the end of the spacecraft and praised the work of the NASA team.
I hope you're all as deeply proud of this amazing accomplishment. Congratulations to you all. This has been an incredible mission, an incredible spacecraft, and you're all an incredible team. I'm going to call this the end of mission.
The crash was planned by scientists and engineers at NASA's JPL. NASA is the United States Space Agency. They decided to end the mission this way because of an important find during the mission, the possibility of life on one of Saturn's moons. Saturn is the sixth planet in our solar system. It is known for its famous rings and many moons. Cassini's study of the system of Saturn's rings and moons brought many surprises. The researchers discovered ocean worlds that may contain the elements for life on some of Saturn's moons. Morgan Cable is an assistant project science systems engineer.
At the time of its design, we had no idea that ocean worlds existed in the outer solar system.
Another unexpected discovery came from the south pole of Enceladus, a moon that sits in one of Saturn's rings. Molly Bittner is a spacecraft operations systems engineer. She explains what they found out about Enceladus.
It has a liquid water ocean underneath, and it shoots geysers. So these cracks open up and geysers shoot out.
Instruments on Cassini have examined the grains and gas coming from that geyser plume. Engineer Morgan Cable explains that instruments on board Cassini helped researchers learn what was in that geyser plume.
We know that there are salts. Now, this is important for life because life needs certain minerals and salts to exist. We have very strong evidence that there are hydrothermal vents down at the base of that ocean, at the ocean floor. Now, anytime you find hydrothermal vents here on Earth, you find rich communities of organisms.
Cassini was also able to gather data from Titan, Saturn's largest moon. It has lakes and seas of liquid methane and ethane instead of water. There is also evidence of a liquid ocean beneath the surface that probably contains ammonia and water. Scientists and engineers say the environment could hold life. Morgan Cable says life there may look different than on our planet.
We're still open to trying to look for weird life in places like this, and we've found a strange place right here in our own solar system.
The possibility of life on Saturn's moons made NASA engineers think about how best to end Cassini's mission as it ran out of fuel. Cassini carried organisms from Earth. They did not want it to land on a moon like Enceladus because, if it already holds life, Cassini could have contaminated it.
I want to find life elsewhere, on a place like Enceladus, but I don't want to realize later on that we put it there.
Scientists and engineers are already looking ahead to future missions back to Saturn and its moons. Cable says they want to look deeper into the possibility of finding life there.
And I think with today's instrumentation, things that we could put on a spacecraft right now, we could find that life with our instruments of today.
Right up until it crashed into Saturn, Cassini was still sending back important data to Earth. That information will keep researchers busy as they analyze it for years to come. I'm Ann Ball.
Now we hear part of an interview with Jonas Salk, creator of the polio vaccine. It comes from the Academy of Achievement as part of the podcast series, What It Takes.
In the 1940s and early 50s, summer was terrifying. The polio virus was most contagious during the hot months and struck tens of thousands of children every year. Almost 60,000 in 1952 alone. It left wasted muscles, paralysis, and sometimes death in its wake. If your child caught the virus, she might end up lying in an iron lung, in a hospital lined up with rows and rows of other children in iron lungs, their heads all jutting out from the giant metal barrels, unable to move at all. But then finally, in 1955, a reprieve.
CBS News presents a special report. The Salk polio vaccine is a success. The vaccine works.
The country and the whole world heaved a sigh of relief. Poliomyelitis, or polio, had come in menacing waves for hundreds and possibly thousands of years. Overnight, Dr. Jonas Salk became an unlikely celebrity, a national hero in a lab coat.
There was a great rejoicing, obviously, because of the freedom from fear, or the relief. It was not unlike the ending of a war, if you like. People meet me even now, remembering exactly the moment when this announcement was made. I felt myself very much like someone in the eye of the hurricane, because all this whirling was going on around me, and it was at that moment that everything changed. And it was Edward R. Murrow, the journalist, the newscaster, who said to me that evening, he said, a young man, a great tragedy has just befallen you. I said, what's that, Ed? He said, you've just lost your anonymity. And it was then that I became looked upon as a public figure. And I had to fight and struggle to continue on with my work.
To hear the whole podcast, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Rivers and bridges, you're going to have to crawl.
I look at blues as it's a way of life. It's a story told with music.
I said rivers and bridges.
That voice belongs to Jimmy Duck Holmes, a blues musician. He is sitting on an old chair in a dark corner of the Blue Front Cafe, playing his guitar. Holmes' parents own the cafe, and now it belongs to him. Photographs, vinyl records, and guitars cover its walls. The objects all speak to the 70-year-old artist's life and music. The smell of beer and sounds coming from the jukebox in the corner help create the perfect atmosphere for his history with the blues. Blues music itself tells a story about America.
I said rivers and bridges.
When people think of American music, they probably think of rap, or rock and roll, or jazz. What many may not realize is that these American sounds are all tied to a common place. That place is blues music. The blues was born in the Mississippi Delta area sometime in the late 1800s. The music is rooted in African-American slave spiritual and work songs. Life was hard for black people in the U.S. Slavery technically had ended, but poverty and unjust laws kept people from full freedom. Some former slaves stayed in the South and continued to work on farms, often for their former owners. Much of the work was outside in the fields, in the unforgiving heat of the Mississippi sun. Roger Stoley is a Mississippi blues historian. He says a culture of singing helped people deal with the hardships. People sang spirituals at church and work songs in the fields to make the days go by. Over time, this music developed into what people now call the blues. As the blues grew in popularity, musicians began to perform around the Delta. Some, like B.B. King or John Lee Hooker, would travel to the city of Memphis, Tennessee, to establish professional music careers.
Blues is both American and foreign. Blues historian Scott Beretta says many elements of the blues, including singing styles, rhythm, instrument playing, and pentatonic scale, are African and were brought to the U.S. by those who had been enslaved. Beretta also notes the patterns to the lyrics.
The blues follows an AAB lyrical style. And what we mean by that is that when you perform the blues, you're often singing a verse, repeating the verse, and then there's an answer line. That's a style of music which we really didn't see before around 1900.
When it comes to the words, many musicians sing about difficulties from their own life stories. Holmes is among them.
I don't sing about lies. I tell the truth. True blues, the lyrics are absolutely true. Sing about life experience. Sometimes good, sometimes bad, but they didn't lie.
85-year-old blues musician Leo Bud Welch agrees.
Well, the blues ain't nothing but some good man or woman feeling bad. It's about a life.
Many blues musicians never gained fame. Often, they were farm workers by day and would play at juke joints by night. Juke joints were unofficial businesses where black people could gather to socialize. They would drink, dance, and play music at night. Leo Bud Welch was one of these musicians. He has played the blues since he was 13, about 65 years ago. He only performed music for families and friends.
You know they call me the Hollywood.
It was not until 2013, when Welch was 81, that he recorded his first album. For most of his life, he earned a living as a farm worker and tree cutter.
And my daddy used to take money to make the mouths hot. If you ain't got no money, you can't get nothing done.
Most of the guys who started doing what I'm doing got killed for what they was doing.
With a voice both playful and serious, Bobby Rush speaks as a blues musician as well as a historian. He grew up playing with famous blues musicians like Muddy Waters, Buddy Guy, and Howlin' Wolf. At 83, he is still performing. He just won his first Grammy Award in February for his newest album, Porcupine Meat. Rush's story, like the story of blues music, parallels the story of civil rights in the U.S. Rush, whose great-grandmother was a slave, often experienced racism early in his career.
In the past, blues had been something that it wasn't good until the white guys did it. When I came along, this was the devil's music.
When Rush started performing professionally, he was sometimes forced to play behind curtains because he is black and the audience was mostly white. Over time, that changed. Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders organized to bring about change through nonviolent resistance. Blacks and whites began protesting racist laws together in the South. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act passed, barring discrimination based on race. Over time, these actions affected the blues world. Now, Rush says he feels blessed for his popularity with a racially mixed audience. But he adds that he will always be proud of his roots and the struggles he went through on his road to success.
I'm a blues singer. I'm a black blues singer. I love what I do. I love who I am, love all people because they're all part of me.
Blues had a critical influence in the expansion of the American music tradition. Over time, as blues musicians left Mississippi, the sound changed. In the North, Chicago and other cities became famous for the electric guitar style of blues, which helped create rock and roll. In the South, blues music was a building block for jazz, country, and bluegrass. Rhythm in blues and rap music also developed from the Mississippi blues. Historian Roger Stolle says, "Today, young people are more interested in learning musical styles like rap than traditional blues. However, there are efforts to document the life of the genre and keep it healthy for the future." The Mississippi Blues Commission has created the Blues Music Trail, a path of historic places throughout Mississippi that informs and entertains visitors about blues music. The history of the music is also on display at the Delta Blues Museum, and it has programs that connect young musicians with established blues artists. Also, record labels are trying to preserve the traditional style of Delta blues by recording older musicians like Welsh and Holmes. But no matter what happens to the genre, almost every form of popular music today has been touched by the blues. And it is almost impossible not to like it, says Bobby Rush.
The blues itself is the mother of all music. Because if you don't like the blues, you don't like your mama. Because this is the root of music, man.
I'm Phil Dierking.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
I've been before the prosecutor, judge and the jury too. They're trying to give me 40 years, y'all.
The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. Part 1.
Paris. It was in Paris during the summer of 1840. There and then, I met a strange and interesting young man named Auguste Dupin. Dupin was the last member of a well-known family, a family that had once been rich and famous. Auguste Dupin, however, was far from rich. He cared little about money. He had enough to buy necessities and a few books. That was all, just books. With books, he was happy. In fact, we first met in an old bookstore. A few more chance meetings at such stores followed. Soon, we began to talk. I was deeply interested in the family history, he told me. I was surprised, too, at how much and how widely he had read. More important, the force of his busy mind was like a bright light in my soul. I felt that the friendship of such a man would be for me riches without price. So I told him how I felt and asked him to come live with me. He would enjoy using my many fine books. And I would have the pleasure of company, for I was not happy alone. We passed the days reading, writing, and talking. But Dupin was a lover of the night. So often we walked the streets of Paris after dark. I soon noticed that Dupin had a special way of understanding people. Using it gave him great pleasure. He told me once, with a soft laugh, that he could see through the windows that most men have over their hearts. He could look into their souls. Then he surprised me by telling what he knew about my own soul. He knew things about me that I had thought only I could possibly know. At these times, he acted cold and emotionally distant. His eyes looked empty and far away. His voice became high and nervous. At such times, it seemed to me that I saw not just Dupin, but two Dupins. One who coldly put things together, and another who just as coldly took them apart. One night, we were walking down one of Paris's long, dirty streets. We were quiet, both busy with our own thoughts. But suddenly, Dupin spoke.
"You're right,"
he said.
"He is a very little fellow, that's true, and he would be more successful if he acted in lighter, less serious plays."
"Yes, there can be no doubt of that," I said. At first, I saw nothing strange in this. Dupin had agreed with me. This, of course, seemed to me quite natural. A few moments passed. Then it hit me. Dupin had not agreed with something I had said. He had agreed directly with my thoughts. I had not spoken a word. Dupin had read my mind. I stopped walking. "Dupin," I said, "Dupin, I don't understand. How could you know that I was thinking of..." Here I stopped speaking. If he really had heard my thoughts, he would have to prove it. And he did. He said,
"How did I know you were thinking of Shanti? You were thinking that Shanti is too small for the plays in which he acts."
"That is indeed what I was thinking. But tell me, in heaven's name, how did you know?"
"It was the fruit seller."
"Fruit seller?"
I mean the man who bumped into you as we entered the street, maybe 15 minutes ago.
Oh, yes, I remember now. A fruit seller with a large basket of apples bumped into me. But what does that have to do with you knowing I was thinking of Shanti?
I will explain. Listen closely now. Let us follow your thoughts from the fruit seller to the stage actor, Shanti. Those thoughts must have gone like this. Fruit seller to cobblestones, cobblestones to stereotomy, stereotomy to Epicurus, to Orion, and then to Shanti.
He continued.
As we turned onto this street, the fruit seller bumped you. You stepped on some uneven cobblestones. I could see that it hurt your foot. You spoke a few angry words to yourself and continued walking. But you kept looking at the cobblestones in the street, so I knew you were thinking of them. Then we came to a small street where they are putting down new street stones. Here your face became brighter. You were looking at these more even stones, and your lips moved. I was sure they formed the word stereotomy, which is the name for how these new stones are cut. Stereotomy takes a large block and divides it evenly into smaller pieces. You will remember that we read about it in the newspaper only yesterday. I thought that the word stereotomy must make you think of the old Greek writer and thinker Epicurus. His ideas are also about dividing objects into smaller and smaller pieces called atoms. He argued that the world and everything else are made of these atoms. You and I were talking about Epicurus and his ideas, his atoms, recently. We were talking about how much those old ideas are like today's scientific study of the planets and stars. So I felt sure that now, as we walked, you would look up to the sky. And you did. I looked also at the sky. I saw that the group of stars we call Orion is very bright and clear tonight. I knew you would notice this and that you would think about the name Orion. Now keep listening carefully. Only yesterday, in the newspaper, there was a report about the actor Shanti. The critic did not praise him, and he used a Latin saying that had also been used to describe Orion. So I knew you would put together the two ideas of Orion and Shanti. I saw you smile, remembering the article and the mean words in it. Then I saw you straighten up, as tall as you could make yourself. I was sure you were thinking of Shanti's size, and especially his height. He is small, he is short, and so I spoke, saying that he is indeed a very little man, this Shanti, and he would be more successful if he acted in lighter, less serious plays.
I cannot say I was surprised by what Dupin had just reported. My reaction was much bigger than just surprise. I was astonished. Dupin was right as he could be. Those were, in fact, my thoughts, my unspoken thoughts, as my mind moved from one thought to the next. But if I was astonished by this, I would soon be more than astonished. One morning, this strangely interesting man showed me once again his unusual reasoning power. We heard that an old woman had been killed by unknown persons. The killer, or killers, had cut her head off and escaped into the night. Who was this killer? This murderer? The police had no answer. They had looked everywhere and found nothing that helped them. They did not know what to do next. And so they did nothing. But not Dupin. He knew what to do. That's all the time we have for the show today. From VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.